So what's God's perspective on our president, the White House, world issues, North Korea, Russia? We'll do our best to step back and give you a kingdom perspective on the news.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Hey, did you ever wonder about that? Not just what would Jesus do, but what would Jesus say? What is his perspective? What is the Lord's perspective on what's happening in the world around us? Would he say, don't even think about it? Don't even think about your government. Just pray for them. Don't even think about world issues. Just concentrate on worshiping God and making disciples. Would he say you need to understand what's going on so you can better function as salt and light? Would it be different callings for different individuals, some to be more engaged, some to be less engaged? This is Michael Brown. Welcome to The Line of Fire. We will do our best to give you a kingdom perspective on what's happening in the world around us. 866-34-TRUTH, if you'd like to call in, if you have a question for me, if you have an area where you differ with me, give me a call, 866-348-7884. That is the number to call. Okay, when it comes to our president, yes, things have been chaotic in terms of people in, people out. Different press secretary, different chief of staff, Anthony Scaramucci, brought on and then 10 days later let go. No sooner did I write an article on what the hiring of Anthony Scaramucci tells us about President Trump. No sooner did I write that than he was fired. I could have written another article 2 days later because I wrote it on a Friday. It was posted on Sunday, Monday. And it was a Monday that he was fired yesterday, so I could have written an article, just changed it from what the firing of Anthony Scaramucci tells us. I mean, that's how quickly things have changed, as people are saying there's chaos in the White House, and President Trump has been saying there's no chaos. I was reminded of the book that my friend Lance Wallnau wrote called God's Chaos Candidate about President Trump. And this is when he was candidate Trump, depicted as somewhat of a divine wrecking ball. And as we've said many times, wrecking balls do a lot of good. Wrecking balls do a lot of harm. When you've got an old building that needs to be demolished, that wrecking ball does an amazing job in a short period of time. When you're looking to renovate a bedroom in your house, you don't want to use a wrecking ball. The whole house will come down. There are times for wrecking ball. There are times for surgeons. But the idea of Donald Trump being God's chaos candidate, it seems that the chaos, and this was Lance Wallnau writing in a supportive way, not a critical way, it really seems like the chaos has continued in that regard. And of course, there's constant fodder for the news outlets. It's like feeding bloody meat to a shark in water. I mean, they're swarming on the latest story and so much to talk about, endless news cycles. But in the midst of it, are we able to step back and say, well, what is God doing? Are we able to step back and say, what should our response be? And on a regular basis that I hear from people, when are you going to admit that you were wrong about Donald Trump? By which some mean, when are you going to admit that you were wrong and not backing him enthusiastically? Others mean, when are you going to be wrong for not ongoingly tearing him down in a critical way? So I'm not out to please people, because whatever I say, some are going to like, some are not going to like, some are going to be indifferent. But bottom line is this, we'll do our best to speak the truth and sort issues out. So give you some perspective. Oh, second hour, we're going from climate change to loving our enemies. A lot more to come. Stay with us.
The
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, before we give you some kingdom-related thoughts on what's happening in the White House and even some questions about North Korea and Russia and where things are going, before we get into that, I want to revisit once again the tragic situation with Charlie Gard. There's another case in the UK where a baby is on life support. There are at least a half dozen hospitals I've read in America that say they're willing to treat the child. The doctors in England are recommending the child be taken off life support, even though they don't know why exactly he's been in a coma these months, as I've read, as I understand the situation. So the question is there something different in America? Are our policies different in America? I heard from an emergency room physician, emergency care physician in Singapore, who wrote with respect for our ministry and with concern because of the amount of influence we have in lots of people's lives, that what I wrote about Charlie Gard is misleading and separates us from focusing on the real issue, which is euthanasia. And this physician's feeling was that I was against palliative care and that I don't realize that every single day doctors are making life and death decisions and courts have to be involved with end-of-life issues, and these are cases that we face in America as well. So because of the passion with which this doctor communicated to us, and because he had posted things on Facebook and then written to our ministry, and then it was passed on to me by folks in our ministry. So every so often, there'll be something that our team feels is especially important for me to look at, and I'll take a look at. In other words, out of everything that comes in, the staff normally is able to respond, but every so often they'll say, you need to look at this. So I wrote back. I sent some other articles that I felt were relevant, and I want to make a few things clear. And then if you're listening and you're a doctor, or you're involved in healthcare, or you're involved in courts regarding healthcare, I'd love to get your perspective. I posted this on Facebook, and I'll see if I get some responses. But here's what I found. And this was the government website of the NCBI, and it was ethical and legal issues relating to children, when children die. And NCBI, what does that stand for? National Council of Bio. Hang on, let's look it up. NCBI stands for National Center for Biotechnology Information. And this article that I found was maybe a decade old or so, but in it, it said this, all right? When cure for a child's medical problem is unlikely or impossible, however, courts have been increasingly willing to allow parents to make decisions based on their subjective analyses of risks and benefits. If another physician can be found who agrees with the parents and testifies that she or he will assume responsibility for the care of the child, after the original physicians declined to follow the parents' wishes, all courts will permit parents to remove their child to the other physician, even if the original physicians are convinced that the new physician's therapies are outside any accepted medical standard. If a child's life is not immediately threatened, even if the underlying condition is desperately serious, most courts' longstanding practice is to refuse to order that high-risk therapies be given over parental objection. So you've got two sides here, from what I understand, and I'll be eager to see what medical professionals add in terms of comments on our Facebook page on Ask Dr. Brown. And if it's easier for you to just comment there, you're unable to call in, but you're hearing this maybe after the show, you're not hearing it live, or maybe you're at work and you can't call in, go to the Ask Dr. Brown Facebook page, ASKDR Brown, like the page there, and then go ahead and comment on this. So it seems you have two scenarios here. One scenario where a child is dying because this is having to do with ethical and legal issues with death of children, all right, children who are dying in hospitals, things like that. So let's say every doctor in the hospital says there's nothing more we can do for your child. There's no further treatment. Your child is slowly dying, and we wish we had something else to tell you. Our hearts break, but maybe your child has a month or two to live. And you parents, you're searching online. You're looking for every option. You find a doctor. He's a holistic doctor, but a medical professional. He's got a completely different treatment. There's no guarantee it's going to work. It hasn't been proven to work, but there's a possibility that it would work. And he's willing to take the responsibility to say, hey, I want to go ahead and treat, not guaranteeing anything, right? I want to go ahead and treat your child. That, as I understand this, that the courts will normally say, okay, it's up to the parents to make this decision as long as another physician is willing to sign off, all right? And the hospital couldn't stop you, and the courts will say, let the parents make their decision. Even if it is subjective and highly unlikely, as long as another physician is willing to help. Now, would that parallel the Charlie Gard case, where a professor in the U.S. said that he was willing to administer an experimental treatment, and they had money raised to bring him over to the States? In my mind, this would be a parallel. So if this had been in America, then the courts would have been inclined to say, go ahead and do this, even though all the doctors right there with the child recommend against it. It's your choice as the parents, and there's another doctor willing to take responsibility. Okay, that's number one. Second case scenario seems to be that if the hospital says, listen, we can extend your child's life by a few months. This is a high-risk treatment. It's not proven, but we really want to do it. The parents say no, and the doctors cannot force them to, according to the view of courts. That's what I understand this to be saying. Now, when it comes to Charlie Gard, when it comes to the question of palliative care, I'm all for palliative care when it is the right thing to do, because we can potentially keep someone, quote, alive even for years, even though there's nothing really alive about them. They're just hooked up to machines. And obviously it's gut-wrenching to make the decision to unplug a machine that's keeping someone alive. But if you realize they're completely brain dead, they've been brain dead for weeks, there's no possible hope of change coming, then you have to just accept a certain fact and go with it, because in years past and centuries past, you could not preserve someone's life the way we do today. So we can unnaturally keep someone, quote, alive too long. We have that capability. So I understand doctors, hospitals, parents, individuals, children are for their parents are making decisions constantly. We were asked last fall to make these decisions regarding my mom. She was hospitalized. She'd been in the emergency room about four different times for different things and was in the hospital being treated. And we got a call. They wanted to meet with us, had to fill out all these forms about palliative care. So palliative care would be akin to hospice, that you know there's no further treatment, so you want to keep them comfortable. And you want to do it in an environment which is not as sterile and unfamiliar and unfriendly as a hospital can be, because hospitals are not there for social atmosphere. They're there to save lives and preserve lives. So a palliative care setting can often be more friendly and less sterile in that regard. I don't mean sterile in terms of clean. I mean sterile in terms of just the general atmosphere. So we were asked to come in and meet and discuss palliative care, which would mean that certainly within the next few months, they were expecting her to pass away. What happened was she just started to get stronger, and everyone was kind of shocked. So she went back to the place that she was that had ongoing care whenever needed, and then passed away suddenly there. But I was ready for it, if that's what they recommended. After all, she was 94 years old. We knew she was getting weaker and weaker and weaker and having a harder time just functioning. So palliative care would have made perfect sense. And remarkably, she wasn't on medication or anything like that. She she wasn't on life support, but they were going to put her in a different atmosphere. There's a time and place for that, and I'm all for it. And ultimately, little Charlie passed away in a hospice setting. The parents wanted to bring him home, and the medical profession ruled against it. The courts ruled against it. Medical profession recommended against it, getting the equipment in the house, different things they felt was just not viable and workable. So little Charlie passed away in a hospice setting. Yes, there is a time for that. I'm not debating that at all. My question remains, who gave the hospital, who gave the doctors authority to tell the parents that they couldn't get experimental treatment for their child when there was a professor, a doctor in America willing to administer it? We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks so much for joining us on The Line of Fire, 866-348-7884. Listen, I know that many of you take my words seriously and believe that I do careful research before I speak, that I think things through before I speak. And that is the case. By God's grace, I do my best to be accurate, to be careful. When I'm not sure about something, to tell you that. When I don't have expertise in an area, to tell you that. When I feel strongly about something, to tell you that. But like everything else, it's important that you weigh what I say, that if it's a controversial issue, that you really look at the facts, that you weigh things based on the level of expertise that I have in a particular area, and treat my words the same as anyone else's in that regard, that you take things as seriously as they should be taken, or not, depending on your assessment and your evaluation. So James, Jacob, the third chapter, says not many of you should be teachers, because there'll be greater accountability for those of us who are teachers. So leaders are accountable not just for their own lives, but the lives of those they influence. And I do not want to be writing one thing one week and then correcting it the next week and retracting the next week. I got no business doing that. And even though this is live radio, there are plenty of things that come up that I'm going to chew on. I'm going to wait. If I don't have something constructive to say or edifying or useful or helpful or with insight, keep my mouth shut. That's why there are plenty of things I don't comment on, because I don't think I have something fruitful and constructive to say. When it comes to our president, please hear me on this. Whatever I say, understand that I am not his defender and I am not his attacker. My goal is not to make him look good or bring on a flood of guests that speak well of him or cherry pick things to puff him up and to say what a great job he's doing. My goal is not to attack him and every day to bring on critics and then to talk about what's wrong here or there. My goal is to be constructive and especially to say to my fellow believers in Jesus, to my fellow followers of the Lord, here's how we should evaluate things. I gave the analogy in my recent article using this figure. And I've mentioned it before. Let me mention it again. Think of someone who is an old world Italian mafia leader, all right? But he has a great respect for the Catholic Church, even though within his own organization, he's a ruthless guy. To him, that's just business. This is the way the business is run, and it holds things together. You know, you need the crime syndicate. They do their job to hold things together. He rationalizes it, whatever. But he has great respect for the Catholic Church, even though he himself is not a church-going man. And he finds out that the local parish is having real problems financially. The building needs renovation. So he secretly gives a large donation to fix the building and make it better than it was, because he has great respect for the Catholic Church and feels it has an important role in the society. All right, I'm giving this hypothetical analogy here. Now let's go one step further. Father, one step farther. Yeah, difference between further and father. Let's go one step farther. So let's say that the priest, he finds out, is getting threatened by some thugs, some young thugs in the area. And they don't like him. They're threatening to beat him up or something. So the mafia leader sends one of his serious hitmen, and he tells these young guys, you threaten him one more time, and you're going to wake up dead on the bottom of the river with concrete blocks around your feet. You think, well, wait. That's completely contradictory, because he's standing up for a priest, but he's threatening to kill people harassing the priest. Yeah, well, there would be the contradiction in the person, but I think you could wrap your minds around that and see that. So as I look at the president, here's what I see. Even in his partying, worldly days, from what I could tell, he still had a certain respect for the church and respect for religion, although he himself was far from leading a godly life. That's one. Two, as he's gotten older, he has settled down more, which happens with plenty of people, and become more conservative in some of his views, while remaining the same person he's been, with his strengths and his weaknesses, with his good qualities and his bad qualities. Now, as he leaned forward towards running for president a couple years back, he began to associate with more and more evangelical Christians and godly leaders and individuals. Was this all a ploy to get votes because he's trying to court the favor of whoever he can court? And here's a group he knows is important, voting bloc. And if he can get their votes by being a pro-life candidate and so on and say, I stand for your religious liberties, he'll do it. Hey, after all, he's a con man. He's a businessman. He'll sell when he needs to sell. Whatever his motivation was initially, I don't know what it was. God knows. And you don't. Hey, you don't know either. Let's not judge the secrets of people's hearts. We don't know. What has become clear, though, is that he is impressed by these leaders. He admires lots of qualities about them. He feels that they are standing for many things that are in America's best interests. All of this is positive. And he's genuinely embraced a pro-life position. He may not be able to articulate it the way others would, pro-life leaders. He may not be 100% on every issue exactly the way we would say it, but he's genuinely embraced a pro-life position. And he genuinely wants to be a champion of evangelical believers and other people of faith that are religious liberties are preserved. And it's clear by decisions he's made that he didn't have to make. You say, well, he's just appealing to his base. Well, that's not his only base, number one. And number two, from everything I can tell, from people who have been with him in private, from some who have known him for years and some who have known him for months, he sincerely seems to want to be a champion of causes that are important to us. Does he still say and do things that I find objectionable? Highly. Do I wish that he would go through different processes sometimes? Absolutely. But I am better able to understand who the man is and how God is using him in the midst of the flaws and the errors and the mistakes. Okay? Now, I don't think it's good with a revolving door, so to say, with, you know, this one hired, this one fired. And you can question the way he fired James Comey, with Comey apparently finding out that he was fired when he saw a TV report and just thought it was a joke at first. There are things that, again, I wish were done differently. Let him lead. Let him bypass what he feels is a lot of red tape. There are many things, tweets he sent out, and yet I could see sincerity in stands that he's taken. So this is just based on my observation. So when I make these statements, it's not as a critic of the president or as a defender of the president, but as one trying to understand the truth, speak the truth, and help us understand the man leading our country.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Hey, how many times have you heard me talk about climate change and is it man-made and the climate change movement? Almost never, correct? Why? Because I've never studied the issue, and I don't feel that I have much to say about the issue. Oh, I could just get on one bandwagon or the other, right? Or take the staunch conservative line or the skeptical line towards climate change, or just bash the, you know, the tree huggers, right? I could say, well, most scientists say this, but it hasn't been an area of focus for me. I'm not saying it's unimportant. It hasn't been an area of focus for me. That's one. And two, I just don't have expertise there. But in the second hour, my friend Larry Tomczak is going to come on, and he's got some comments and thoughts regarding an Al Gore book coming out on climate change and man-made climate change. So we'll be talking to him about that. And then also in the second hour, my friend James Robison, we want to talk about the importance of prayer and then loving our enemies into the kingdom. But let me give you an analogy here, little story, and then I'll apply it to our president. Stories told about an old woman, destitute, loved the Lord, but dirt poor, lived in a little house. And one day, this boy, who was a real religion mocker, God mocker, he is walking through the place where she and others live, passes her little rundown house, and hears her praying. Oh God, you're faithful. I love you. I trust you. Right now, Lord, you know I don't have a dime in my pocket. I don't have any money. I don't have any groceries. I'm hungry, Lord, and I don't know what to do. So I'm just asking you, Lord, I'm gonna take a walk. I'm going to leave this house. I'm going to take a walk for an hour or two. And when I come back, I'm believing that you are going to provide groceries for me right here in my house. So this woman of great faith, but no earthly means, takes a walk, and this boy thinks, oh, are you kidding me? What a perfect setup. I'm going to run into town because I can do that and be back in a half hour. I'm going to buy groceries for her with my own money. I'm going to climb in through the window here, put them on her table, and I'm going to stand outside and listen to her because she's going to think God did it, whereas I did it. So guy hustles into town, gets stuff for sandwiches and, you know, meats and vegetables, fruit, and all that thing's cool. Fills up a couple bags, runs back with the bags in his arm, looks around, no one sees him, sneaks in through the window, puts them on a kitchen table, and then he just perches out behind the house waiting for her to come home. She comes home, opens the door, sees the bags on the kitchen table, and begins to cry. And she begins to praise God. And she says, oh, God, you worked a miracle. You sent me food. Oh, God, I can't thank you enough. You're so faithful. You're a miracle-working God. And the little boy pries open the window and goes, lady, God didn't send that food. I brought it. And she says, I don't care if the devil brought it. God sent it. So here's the deal. Whether you think Donald Trump is acting with ulterior motives, whether you think this is all a con, whether you think he's just trying to appeal to the conservative base that got him elected and he knows he needs the help of these white evangelicals or whoever, whatever you think, whatever your analysis, and just be careful not to go beyond where you should go in terms of statements and judgments and things like that. But even if that was all true, the fact is Neil Gorsuch got in either way. The fact is the president banned those who identify as transgender from serving in the military. The fact is he didn't celebrate June as Gay Pride Month. The fact is he's standing strongly with Israel in a number of key ways. The fact is he's appointing other justices of the same quality as Neil Gorsuch to district and circuit court appointees appointments. And these justices could even be more influential because 99% of cases never even make it to the Supreme Court. So whatever the motivation, where there is good that's happening in the midst of chaos and flaws, rejoice in that. We'll be right back.
It's
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on the Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. Yesterday afternoon, second hour, I talked about strengths and weaknesses of the King James Version of the Bible. God willing, in weeks ahead, we'll highlight different translations, versions, paraphrases, and talk about strengths and weaknesses. But the first time we're doing this, focusing on specific verses, we talk about Bible translations many times. We started, of course, with the grandest English translation of them all, the one that was the translation for centuries in the English world, the King James. Talked about strengths and weaknesses. If you missed any of that, just go to the Line of Fire website, thelineoffire.org, and when you are there, just click on Listen, and you'll find yesterday's show. We're also going to post that as a YouTube video. We video recorded it as I was talking. That'll be posted as well shortly. We'll let you know about that. Also, do you know if you pre-order, go to savingasickamerica.com and pre-order with Amazon, with Barnes & Noble, with whoever you, Christian book, whoever you order from online, if you pre-order, you'll get sent immediately the first four chapters of the book in PDF, and you'll also get a free ebook that I wrote called Five Ways to Pray for America. So if you haven't pre-ordered yet, go to savingasickamerica.com. Watch the trailer. If you're not sure if you want to pre-order, download for free the intro and first chapter of the book. That's at savingasickamerica.com. You can also watch the trailer that lots of folks are talking about, calling awesome and very, very powerful. 866-34-TRUTH. Okay, that got posted to the wrong place. So let me just change that there. Okay, still waiting for folks to weigh in. We have lots of Facebook followers, well over a half million, and they comment very actively, but I asked a very specific question for doctors or folks involved in healthcare, and it's technical, so we haven't gotten comments yet. Last night, I tweeted something out, and then I posted it as well on our Facebook page, and I just said this, pastors and worship leaders, remember, you're called to edify, not entertain. To equip a spiritual army, not perform for a watching audience. Something had happened earlier in the night that made me think of that, and because of that, I posted that comment. Well, I expected, just automatically, that virtually everybody would agree with it. Virtually everybody would say amen or add in a comment. In other words, I found nothing controversial about it. For anyone that really loves the Lord and those in ministry that love the Lord and love the people of God, every pastor I work with, every worship leader I work with would agree with that statement. I don't think there's anything controversial about it. And as I look now, it reached over 54,000 people and got so far over 1,700 likes and almost 500 shares. But I was shocked to see that one person, we ultimately had to block them, they got so offensive, accused me of attacking those who preach the cross, wanted to make a buck off of my attacks, and slandering the Spirit to the point of blasphemy. Unreal. I mean, you make a comment that is a truthful comment. I'm not mentioning names, anything like this. I'm wanting people to preach the cross. I'm wanting people to lead us into the presence of God. And yet, it gets taken a certain way. So here's a little teachable moment, okay? I don't know if you've done this, but I have often misheard what someone was saying. Either I misread one word and I thought it said something else, or I misunderstood why they were saying what they were saying. I heard them through a particular context, all right? I heard them through, I filtered it wrongly. And because I filtered it wrongly, I thought that they were saying something very different, okay? And often we do that. I may say something and you may assume I'm a certain person or coming from a certain perspective. I remember, for example, when we were having weeks of discussion about racial tensions. We were having weeks of interaction. It was probably after the killing of Trayvon Martin and the Zimmerman trial and so on. And we were talking about these issues, and I was constantly trying to understand different perspectives. What if I grew up in a poor neighborhood? What if I grew up in a more affluent neighborhood? What if I grew up in an African-American home? What if I grew up in this environment or that environment? So I was learning so much from my listeners because of different perspectives and different upbringings. And as we've had these discussions over the years, they really shaped my understanding. So I could say things pretty plainly. I could say things pretty plainly and pretty forthrightly because over months of talking and years of people listening to me, we'd built up a certain rapport and a certain trust. So I summarized a lot of things by saying, as I see it, that white Americans often don't see racism when it is there, and black Americans often see racism when it isn't there. These are our respective blind spots. And people are calling in Hispanic, Asian, white, black, different backgrounds and agreeing with what I was saying. But then somebody called in hostile, negative, angry with me. He happened to be a listener that had not normally listened to me. And his thing was, who gives you the right to talk about this? You didn't grow up where I grew up. You didn't live where I lived, etc. And I was somewhat shocked, except when we talked, I found out they had just tuned in the first time that day. Ah, you didn't have the context of the conversation and the trust that had been earned between my listeners and me over that period of time. Here, I was just last night playing a game on my phone. I have a word game that I'll play maybe once a day for a few minutes, just for a little diversion. And you have these definitions, and you have to find the words that are broken up in pieces. And it's, you know, I might play it for 2-3 minutes, something like that. And I saw something that said walking the runway, or walk the runway, and it was models. That was the correct word, which is broken up into, you know, smaller syllables, and you had to piece them together, among many others. Well, I read it as walks the plank. It said runway, walks the plank. I'm thinking walks the plank. That's death. That's pirates. That's this. That's that. That's drowning. Walks the plank. And then finally, when I saw models, I thought, oh, wait, I pieced that together. I thought, oh, it says runway, not plank. Now, I've done that. I've just read the word wrong or heard the thing wrong. Often, we make an assumption about where someone's coming from. We mishear a word. We misunderstand a particular thing. We just filter it wrongly. And because of that, I'm saying something that you agree with and you attack me. I'm saying something that you believe and you attack me. Someone wrote a comment attacking a recent article of mine. And in terms of reading comments in response to my articles, because they're posted in many places, maybe I see 1 in 100. If it's a really busy one, maybe I see 1 in 1,000. Sometimes I may see 5 out of 5 comments, but normally figure 1 in 100 I'll see. And I happen to see this one comment attacking my article, point for point, attacking my article. And someone responded, did you read his article? Because what you're arguing is exactly what he said. In other words, they were attacking me for not saying ABC, whereas I did say ABC. Either they only scanned the article, or they just looked at the headline and summary, or they read it wrongly. So let's be careful, friends, not just in what and how we say what we say, but in how we hear, in how we listen, in how we process. And let's also remember, you know the saying, loose lips sink ships? You look at verses like Proverbs 10:19 and Proverbs 13:3 and Proverbs 18:21, among others, about the power of the tongue, Proverbs 15:4, there are many related verses about the power of the tongue. When you look at these verses, you're reminded, wow, look what happens with Anthony Scaramucci. He gets into a very, very influential position, apparently really wanted to have a position like that in the White House, and gives an interview that is completely unhinged and full of profanity and attacking others on the staff. And apparently, from what we understand, that was one of the tipping points that got him dismissed. He was forced to resign by incoming General Kelly as White House Chief of Staff. You realize, man, words, they can bring life, they can bring death. They can open up a lot of doors for you, and they can close in your face. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Okay, one last thing, and then I'm going to grab a call or two. When we look at the world situations with Russia, North Korea, of course, the Russian actions now, evicting, 750 of our diplomatic personnel from Russia, expelling them. This is a payback for things that President Obama did when he wanted to basically slap Russia's hand for interfering in our elections. So according to Vladimir Putin, he was hoping things would change, waiting for change, and without the change, now he was taking action. Along with that, America's looking to impose different sanctions and assuming that President Trump will sign those into law. So things are ongoing in that regard. North Korea continues to act in a more and more defiant way. As crazy and rogue as that nation is, they put an incredible amount of money into military and certainly would be a tremendous threat to South Korea, not to mention other parts of the world. So right now, I don't feel in my own heart a particular tension that I might feel if I felt something was ready to happen. I don't mean I'm perfect in my track record, but normally when there's something really ajar, something really off, I'll sense it, and I don't feel that now. I feel tensions rising. We all do. But I don't feel like we're on the edge of some type of nuclear holocaust. But we need to pray daily, if we can, God, your kingdom come, your will be done on this planet. May your name be hallowed. Pray the Lord's Prayer and then pray it specifically. Lord, your will be done in Russia and North Korea according to your plan, your will. Lord, your restraint where it's needed. Even though you have leaders that some may be hostile to God, some may not know God at all, some may be religious in a certain form, God is God. And we believe God can restrain, God can raise up, God can bring down. Pray for wisdom for our president. Whether you're on his side or not on his side in terms of your own voting and perceptions, pray for wisdom. Don't pray out of emotion. Pray for God's plan and God's best, and then rest in him. This world is always in chaos. This world is always on the edge of explosion. And I believe if not for God's restraining hand, we would have destroyed ourselves long ago. 866-34-TRUTH. We will now switch subjects and go to the phones. David in Baltimore, welcome to the Line of Fire. Hello, David. And David's gone. Yeah, are you there?
Yes, sir. I'm listening.
Go ahead, please.
I was just wondering, in Genesis 25, when Abraham married his last wife, I can't pronounce it, Keturah.
And
his Keturah. And the children he had from them, and he sent them away. And what group of people would that be today? And also, aren't they still Abraham, part of Abraham's seed and part of, not the Isaac covenant or the Ishmael part, but what did God promise them?
Yeah, an excellent question and one that's very rarely asked, David. First, let's just take a look. There's something very, very significant here when we look in Exodus 25. And you see this, verse 1, Abraham again took a wife, so chronologically, this would be after the death of Sarah, right? So if we're reading chronologically, and her name was Keturah, and she bore him Zimram, Yokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, Shua, Yokshan, and then it goes on from there. And then it says, and Abraham, verse 5, gave all that he had to Isaac, but Abraham gave gifts to the sons of the concubines which Abraham had. While he was still living, he sent them eastward away from Isaac, his son, to the country of the east. So basically it's saying, okay, you're my offspring physically, and I'm going to bless you with gifts, but I'm sending you away because the promised land, that belongs to Isaac and his seed. So you're absolutely right that neither the promises to Isaac nor the promises to Ishmael apply to them. And from what Paul tells us in Romans 9, he reminds us that the promises go by way of the promised seed. So it's Abraham to Isaac, Isaac to Jacob, Jacob to the 12 tribes of Israel. So when God says, I'll bless those who bless you, who does that apply to? That applies to the 12 tribes of Israel. That's why Balaam in the book of Numbers speaks that same blessing over the tribes of Israel, not over the Ishmaelites, not over the descendants of Keturah. So they would be part of his physical offspring, but with no particular covenantal blessing. And some of them, of course, would be completely lost in history. Others, for example, Midian, if we assume that this is the forefathers of the people of Midian or related to them, these would be among Arab peoples, Arab tribes. But you have a lot of shifting in the Middle East, sir, in the ancient world, in the ancient Middle and Near East, and different groups ruling and taking over and dominating or migrating. So we really can't trace most of them with any specificity. But if we could, we'd probably find most of them in these Middle Eastern tribes today that are much of the Arab and Muslim world. That would be the assumption. We just can't prove it definitively in most cases.
All right, but I was also wondering, Doctor, that due to Satan, is it not true that Isaac and Ishmael, and not talk about Keturah,
yeah,
they are brothers, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And I keep wondering that Satan has the Jewish people and the Muslim or Ishmael's descendants at each other's throat, hating each other. So it seems to me that he has them in two ways. First, that neither one believe in Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. Two, that they fighting amongst each other. Three, if they die without Christ, he wins all the way around the board. He has the brothers killing each other, the descendants of the brothers, killing each other, hating each other, and dying without Christ. And I keep thinking about that. So what would be your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And the same way the law was given through the seed of Abraham, through Isaac, and the prophets came through the seed of Abraham, through Isaac, the Messiah comes through the seed of Abraham, through Isaac, and the apostles do as well. So, I mean, you have on the one hand this profound blessing that's come, but only the remnant who's received it. So, David, you're right. The devil's worked overtime. And then through, if you want to say through the descendants of Ishmael, as Muslims would trace it, you have a strongly monotheistic religion that has turned people away from idols. But we'd say they're not knowing God as he really is, the one true God. Interestingly, Genesis 16:12, the end of the verse about Ishmael, King James, New King James translate, he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. ESV, he shall dwell over against all his kinsmen. NIV, he will live in hostility towards all his brothers. Some have thought that it was prophesied that Ishmael would live in hostility with Isaac, but you could make a good case for just reading that he'll live away from his brothers or alongside them as opposed to be in hostility. Take a look in Isaiah 19, sir. Isaiah 19. It speaks of an end time vision where Assyria, which is modern day Iraq, and Egypt, great countries in the Muslim world, will worship alongside of Israel. So there will be a turning. By God's grace, that's what we pray for. That's what we long for. We want to see Satan lose here big time. Thank you. From climate change to loving our enemies into the kingdom, we've got you covered today here on The Line of Fire.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I want to give you an encouraging update and call for your prayer support for one of our sisters on the front lines. This is Michael Brown. It's my delight to be with you today. In a few minutes, I'm going to be joined by my friend Larry Tomczak. We're going to talk about climate change. Al Gore has a book coming out. How seriously should we take the issues of climate change and man-made climate change? Second half hour, I'm going to speak with my friend James Robison about the importance of prayer and how to love our enemies into the kingdom of God. Before that, let me give you an update. If you were listening to the show on Friday, in the second half hour, I got a call from a woman, an anonymous caller from somewhere in America, who worked at a Planned Parenthood clinic and is herself a Christian. Took the job as a single mom 4 months ago because she needed the money, but has felt miserable working there, stopped going to church because she felt miserable, and broke down crying on the air talking about what happens to babies in Planned Parenthood facilities. And I told her plainly she could not go back to work. She didn't want to. I said, you can't. It's not right in God's sight. I assured her that God would forgive her, that God has never left her, which is why she feels this conviction while working there, and that if she needed help in the process, that we knew folks that would gladly stand by her side. Many immediately contacted us and said, you know about Abby Johnson? And we hope to have Abby on the air in the coming weeks. Abby Johnson had worked as a director of a Planned Parenthood clinic, and then watching an ultrasound saw the baby trying to fight for its life and ultimately get killed and traumatized her. She left. Planned Parenthood tried to silence her. In the courts, of course, they couldn't. And she ended up having a work helping people that leave Planned Parenthood because they come under pressure and maybe they're offered more money and just do this and whatever it is. So I read from a colleague that I think it's 335 people now that she's documented have left Planned Parenthood, and they're obviously the greatest voice to tell women and tell men what actually happens in these clinics. So but before we even heard that, we reached out to David and Jason Benham and Cities for Life, because this is a major ministry that they have, a pro-life ministry based in Charlotte, North Carolina, but with templates that are being used around the country. And we got someone from Cities for Life, a woman, to reach out to our anonymous caller. And yesterday, the sister notified Planned Parenthood that she would not be coming back. Yes, they offered her more money. Yes, she was told about the importance of what they do there, and you don't want to have back alley abortions and things like that. But she's held her ground. The Cities for Life organization is helping send her resume out to others for potential work. And obviously, as if it's an immediate financial need, there are friends who will help her through that process. But these are life and death issues, friends, and I'm not on the radio to entertain anybody. We have fun together. We enjoy our time together. But I'm not here to entertain. I'm here to edify and build up and strengthen. And I thank God for this format of live talk radio. This is why we do what we do. If you missed the call, just go to my website, askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. You'll find it there, and you can listen for yourself. We put it on YouTube. It's just the audio, but it's been reported. Now, Christian Post did an article on it. Faith Wire did an article on it. The Blaze did an article on it. So this woman's voice is getting out and speaking to many. We'll be right back with Larry Tomczak, and we'll talk climate change. Shake the nation, change the world. Change the world.
Send it, Lord.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. One of the subjects that you know I virtually never comment on is climate change. I have not studied it. I have no expertise in it. I know the larger scientific consensus that we hear about. I know others saying it's not a consensus and numbers have been fudged and so on. And, well, there is climate change, but it's not man-made. Well, Al Gore has a new book coming out about this. Obviously, he's been the best-known proponent of fighting against so-called man-made climate change. My friend Larry Tomczak, cultural commentator, has written about this. So I thought, well, it's relevant. I don't have expertise, but Larry's dug into this. So let's bring Larry on to talk about it. Hey, great to have you on the broadcast. Thanks for joining us today.
Honor again, and thank you for the privilege. That we're going to learn some things, I hope.
Yeah, so Larry, how did you get involved in studying this issue?
Well, you know what, Mike? Let me tell you this honestly. And you've stayed in our home. You and I are longtime friends, so you understand this. I carry a burden that we as Christians are good stewards of the earth. I believe all of us have a responsibility and this challenge. And we raised our kids just like you. You know, you honor God's creation. You avoid waste and be mindful of the less fortunate. And so, if you were in our home, you know, folks, you would know. I keep the thermostat pretty high at times and pretty low at other times. And we wear sweaters and have heaters, and we don't waste anything. We have some little solar panels to get energy. And so I'm committed, and I say this up front, because sometimes when you talk about this topic, Mike, and this is how I got into it, I thought we're called to be good stewards of the earth, and we're called to, you know, be concerned with legitimate environmental issues. And so that's always been my approach for 48 years as a Christian. But I've noticed over the decades there's been some alarmist movements and champions of some things in this realm that I believe can carry things too far and produce fear in people. And then they start doing things or acting in certain ways contrary to what I believe is a balanced and healthy Christian life. And by the way, Al Gore now, it's not just a book. It's $25.99. You can see it in the stores. But he has a movie. It's breaking. It'll be out this weekend nationwide. And, his first one 10 years ago was An Inconvenient Truth. But now this is an inconvenient sequel. And I see some real problems with this, as I did with the first one.
All right. So let's start to break them down. You have how many problems with what he's presenting here?
Oh, I got a lot of them. I did a study, Mike. You know what? In the 70s, 1970, there was an Earth Day. Now, this was not Al Gore's cause, but there were all kinds of predictions, and they didn't come true. There was going to be end of civilization in 15, 30 years, new ice age by 2000, 100 to 200 million deaths by starvation yearly for 10 years. None of them came to pass, but there was alarmism back then. And then Al Gore put forth a movie, and he listed, I'm not kidding you, predictions. And I literally went back because major experts, they disagree on this. They say this is junk science. People are getting scared. Plus, Al, our buddy, he lives here in Tennessee. Al is getting rich off this. I appreciate people that are entrepreneurs, but, I mean, he left the White House with $2 million. Now he's up to $200 million, and they say he's going to be our first carbon billionaire. So I looked at some of the predictions that he made, and I can give you as many or a few as you want.
Well, let's start. Let's go through a few. We've got time. Let's do it.
All right. Well, in the first one, you can check all this out. Rising sea level. Well, that was inaccurate and misleading. And they also found he purchased a beachfront mansion after that. That was interesting. Number two was increased tornadoes. Well, they've been declining for decades. Number three, a new ice age in Europe. Well, they've been spared. It never happened. He said, number four, the South Sahara would dry up. Completely untrue. Number five was massive flooding in China and India. Never happened. Number six, melting Arctic. False. They had the largest refreezing in years just 2 years ago. How about this one? Polar bear extinction. Well, they're increasing now in numbers. I could go on and on. And You know, this was so serious that you may recall one of the issues with our former president, President Obama, was when we were, many of us were saying, the most serious issue facing us is terrorism. Well, our former president said, no, it's not that. And what he put forth was, it's this issue of climate change and global warming. And our former president even, you know, made statements there about there's going to be a massive, I'll stop there. I don't want people thinking I'm an alarmist here, but I just say we should not speculate, but rationally and biblically come, let's reason together and let's take a look at what we can do to be good stewards, what we can do to respect and teach our children about the environment and using our resources to help, especially the less fortunate, but not be motivated by fear. Or you may have even seen Hollywood celebrities. They're getting in their big private jets, and they're telling us climate change, global warming, all these problems. And then I think, well, wait, you're getting in your private jet. Why don't you do something about it?
Right. If you're going to fly, just get on a commercial plane and cut down, or maybe don't fly at all because of all the emissions and things. So Larry, here's a question, though.
Yes.
There are people who think that when we reject the climate change hysteria or when we question Al Gore, it's like we're questioning established science, that all scientists agree. It's just you crazy fundamentalist Christians who for some reason can't accept this, or you have your conservative agenda, whatever it is. Is it true that this is just slam dunk, that all scientists agree with this and you'd have to be a fool not to? Or is there disagreement from what you know in the scientific community as well?
Yes, there definitely is. In fact, I have a dear friend named Chris Rogers, and he is the producer of a film. It's called Climate Hustle, and I recommend it to everyone listening today. You can Google Climate Hustle, Climate Hustle. The film previewed in Paris when the Paris Accord was put forth. And by the way, our president in June removed us from this because it was committing us to billions of dollars in this cause. He said it's a hoax. Hundreds of millions around the world believe this is a hoax, what's being perpetrated here. And so a Climate Hustle previewed while this Paris Accord was taking place. And you'll hear from expert after expert. I'll just quote one. Listen, Patrick Moore, he's the legendary past president of Greenpeace. And environmentalists would say, oh, yeah, Greenpeace. I'm going to quote him. He said, there is no definitive scientific proof through real-world observation that carbon dioxide is responsible for any of the slight warming of global climate which has occurred during the past 300 years. And Mr. Moore, an expert, says he rejects the, quote, science is settled, the debate is over mentality. And more people, I think, are seeing this. Polls are done, and they'll find 91% of Americans are not seeing global warming as the top issue. And so I just keep going back to this. As a Christian, every one of us, be a good steward. Use your resources. We just had a boy from a homeless shelter in our home Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. We blessed him. We got him school clothes. We got him a haircut. We bless people. We try to be generous. But I'm saving resources to bless the less fortunate with my wife and family. But I don't want us as Christians to come into fear or guilt or somehow being, in some kind of, I would say, disagreement with our very God, who promised he would maintain stability in the seasons and the ocean. I mean, Genesis 8:22, Genesis 9:11, Jeremiah 5:22. We serve a sovereign God who's in charge. So please, if you're listening today, you say, well, I hear these things, I'm concerned. I saw Al Gore's book at Costco, and, you know, it says right on, the future of human civilization is under threat. Don't succumb to that kind of fear.
Mm. All right, so healthy, good stewardship. That's common sense. That's part of our biblical responsibility. The book of Revelation even speaks against those who destroy the earth. But the fear-mongering, the idea that civilization is about to collapse, etc., that this is unhealthy and is destructive, and you're saying is also without basis. It is interesting to go back a few decades and read warnings about the coming ice age and the extinction of the human race. Then it's not getting too cold, it's getting too hot. And I'm not mocking scientists. I'm not a scientist at all, so I appreciate their research and work. But Larry, stick around. I've got another question I want to ask you, and then I want to tell readers where they can read your article and find out about the Bullseye Challenge as well. But why is it, Larry, that so many people on the far left, the quote, tree huggers, the extreme animal rights activists, are not pro-life? They tend to be very, very strong abortion proponents. I don't know if you've thought that through, but we got a break here. We'll come back. See if you have any thoughts on that. And then I want people to read your article, so we'll give them some information.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. We are, by God's grace, your voice of moral sanity and spiritual clarity. I've got an important announcement about how to get a free ebook. I'll share that with you in a moment. But first, back to my friend, Larry Tomczak. Larry, years ago, when I lived in Maryland, when you lived in Maryland as well, there was a friend of ours lived a couple miles away, and he told us that folks were going through the neighborhood from Greenpeace. So this is a radical left activist organization, a Save the World organization in terms of environment, things like that. And I'm sure there's some causes they have that are worthy. But this fellow knocked on my friend's door and was raising funds to help save the baby whales. And I'm sympathetic to saving baby whales. I don't want to see them slaughtered needlessly. So he said, you know, we're trying to raise money to save the baby whales. And my friend said to him, I'm more concerned with saving the baby humans. And the Greenpeace guy got angry and walked away in a huff. Have you seen that over the years, Larry, that people that have extreme concern for the environment or for a tree or for an animal going extinct seem to be pro-abortion at the same time?
Yes, I have, Mike, and that's sad. And it just shows, you know, in the Bible, it says that the God of this world has blinded the minds of unbelievers. So the people who are not regenerated, born again, are not seeing things through the eyes that God intended us to see. And so I think we're all made for a cause. Our cause, we know, is advancing God's rule, bringing the gospel to our generation, evangelizing, seeing churches planted. So we know God's priority. But if people are not linked up with the living God, then they look for a cause. So it could be the very cause we're talking of today. And that can be commendable, again, not carrying it to an extreme. But I think, you know, I think it was C.S. Lewis, Mike, that said at the end of time, there's two groups of people. Those that will say, my will be done, and those that say, thy will be done. We say, thy will be done. And so we align and conform to everything God's called us to do, and that is speak up for those that are perishing. We know where life begins. John the Baptist in the womb, here's the word. We stand for pro-life. But other individuals, they'll find a cause, they're selective, but when you start touching this one about human life, unborn babies, abortion, sanctity of life, that's where I think they like to say, well, hey, government is God, or, you know, we choose our own causes. And our appeal is always to listen and try to understand where people are at with certain causes, but then turn and say, but this is a human being in the womb. And, of course, then you see the blindness when they say, well, I don't believe it. It's a blob of tissue or whatever. So, Mike, it's a dilemma. It's a confusing item that we face. So I try to just say to people, I say, look, your desire for the environment, I identify in X, Y, and Z areas, and I commend you for your work. Could I take a few minutes now as I listen to you to share some things about my cause? And then I'll try to share the gospel and, of course, transition to talk, you know, if I can, and say sanctity of human life, which is so close to God's heart. And so what do you do, Mike? Am I on track with that?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there are so many different ways to look at it. I always try to boil things down and think through. I mean, obviously your approach is the winsome approach. And yeah, I've been in your home. I know how you live. I know the frugality and the stewardship. I've witnessed that for many years, for sure. And your desire to help the poor and the needy side by side, take them in your home and help wherever you can. As I've tried to bottom line this in terms of why there are these differences, it just struck me that if you believe that human life is created in the image of God, then that makes us different than animals, that makes us different than the environment. Nature is not God. God is not in a tree the way God is in a human being, a redeemed human being in particular. And I look at it like that, human beings were made with in the image of God, and because of that, we care for justice, and we have, and we're fallen, so we get it wrong as well. So there are these things. We want to do good. We want to help. But if you don't recognize human beings created in the image of God, then, hey, here's a mother, and she's in distress and thinks, I can't bring another kid in the world. Hey, whatever that mom needs, you just, that's great. If it means terminating that pregnancy, that's fine. You do that. But there's that baby eagle that's going to go extinct. And look at the eagle. It's beautiful. And so, I mean, we have these totally skewed ways of looking at things where the life of an animal in the womb becomes more important than the life of a baby in the womb. And to me, it's a fundamental worldview issue. So that gets us back to your bullseye challenge, which we always like to remind folks about. Friends, think of 30 of the top issues of the day, be it cultural issues, moral issues, be it abortion, be it stewardship issues. How do you approach them? My friend Larry Tomczak has put together a series of videos, just a few minutes long. Watch them each day, then get his book on the Bullseye Challenge, and then read the chapter. Larry, how much time do you think someone needs to invest, say, one a day for a month to digest these arguments, to listen, to read?
Oh, Mike, you know, and it's perfect when we talk of today, August the 1st. As there's 31 days this month, you got a day to just simply know, if you will take 15 minutes, that's all, and you get the book just on Amazon, you can get it overnight and start tomorrow. Go 30 days, take 15 minutes, part of your devotional time. And what you do is you watch a video. It's right there, accessible. You watch it, 2-3-4 minute little video on the topic, transgenderism, social justice, as Mike said, these topics. And then you read a brief little chapter in the book. It's like a primer. It'll give you a biblical perspective. You'll be biblically informed on the issue, and you'll have confidence then. Take 2-3 minutes and pray, 15 minutes. You use the month of August. You're going back to school. You're facing new challenges. Mike, it is such a help and resource. So thank you for allowing me to mention. Just, folks, go to bullseyechallenge.com, bullseyechallenge.com, and there it is. You can start the videos now. You'll see them. And then get the book real quick on Amazon. Get it. And go through it as a family. Go through it as a Bible study. Go through it as your church, or maybe as a family, however you want to do it. So, Mike, I commend that. And I know you and I work together. We want, you know, like Martin Luther King said, hey, darkness can't drive out darkness. Only light can. And that's what we're endeavoring to do. And then don't forget Climate Hustle. Check that out. It's an outstanding documentary.
All right, got it. And your article on climate change, where is that posted? Charisma, Barbed Wire, where will they find that?
Yeah, they can go to Charisma News. You know, we put in there like you do, Charisma News or Barbed Wire or WND. WND has it, World Net Daily. And it's just basically a topic. And, you know, here it is. It says 10 reasons to reject Al Gore's, one says, phony climate sequel. Another one says phony baloney climate sequel. And investigate it. Dig in. Read it. You'll see the quotes. You'll get all the hyperlinks, places you can go to. But we've got a task today, and let's keep bringing the gospel to our generation.
Amen. Larry, keep up the great work. It's a joy to partner together.
Thank you. Love you so much.
All right. God bless. All right. Always a delight to talk to my friend Larry Tomczak. And again, he's done far more research into this, looked at it more carefully. So check out what he has to say, evaluate it, and by all means, don't get caught up in the hysteria. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Yes, yes, yes. Prayer makes a massive difference. Yes, I believe in the statement that prayer changes things. Yes, we are changed as we pray and spend time in God's presence, but not only so, because God has ordained prayer, because God answers prayer, because God will do certain things if we pray and not do other things if we don't pray, and he says it plainly in his word, prayer is critically important, and it's amazing with 24 hours in a day and with most of us having expendable time in the course of the day where we can choose to do with that time what we want. It's amazing how little time we spend doing the most important thing we could possibly do, which is spend quality time with God. This is Michael Brown. I'm sharing that with you. I'm sharing it with me as well. In a moment, we're going to talk with James Robison about the importance of prayer and about loving our enemies into the kingdom. But I just want to share this with you quickly. My new book, Saving a Sick America, comes out September 26th with Thomas Nelson Publishers, with a foreword, in fact, by James Robison. And while the book is as sober as you can get, I mean, as eye-opening as you can get in terms of the current state of America, how sick we are, the whole book is a prescription for moral and cultural transformation based on Scripture and with hope for awakening. I believe that the greatest awakening in our history could still be ahead. I personally believe that. It may seem impossible, but I lean into that because what's impossible with man is possible with God. I lean into the impossibility. I lean into the hopelessness, and that puts me totally leaning on God. And I also know this. I have my life. You have your life. I have my family. You have your family. I have my sphere of influence. You have your sphere of influence. What if we, within our own spheres of influence, live out the gospel in your personal life, in your family, in your business, in your associations, in social media, in whatever other setting you have influence, that you live a consistent godly life? So in Saving a Sick America, I lay out all the ways we can do that, how we can be pro-life, how we can move away from a culture of death, which is not just having to do with abortion, but pervasive in our culture, how we can have a purity revolution versus a sexual revolution, how we can overcome the entitlement mentality by practicing biblical principles and the self-centeredness of our society and problems in the education system. In every case, I go back to the Word, back to the Word, back to God and say, here's how we can see change come. I've written an ebook that you can get for free when you pre-order Saving a Sick America. To get instructions on how to do that, go to savingasickamerica.com. You can watch the 3-minute trailer, which many just after watching it, all they say is wow or whoa or powerful. It's a picture in 3 minutes of where we are today in America and how things have changed in the last 40 or 50 years. But you can get a free ebook, How to Pray for America, 5 Ways to Pray for America, free mini ebook that will stir you and bless you and inspire you. So go to savingasickamerica.com and there are instructions. Wherever you normally order, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Christian Book, wherever you normally order, go ahead and order, and then you send in the information. You'll get the free ebook. We'll also send you the first 4 chapters in advance, even though the book doesn't come out until September 26th. So take a minute and do that. Get the free ebook with your pre-order and prepare to be blessed and stirred.
It's It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
You know, I've said this before, but in introducing my friend James Robison, joining us again on the air this week, when I think of my brother, probably the first word that comes to mind is redemptive, loving, and with that, redemptive. And whenever I'm writing articles and I'm always writing on controversial issues, it's been in my heart before, but through my fellowship with James the last few years, it's deepened. Whatever I'm doing, be redemptive, be redemptive. So I want to talk to James Robison about that, as well as talk about the power of prayer. James, thanks for joining us again on the broadcast.
It's always a joy. Thank you, sir.
Well, I know many times we are reactionary. Someone mistreats us, we get angry. Someone pushes us away, we want to push back. But it seems that your reflex, what God's built into you, is when you see something ungodly or someone ungodly or wrong behavior, your response is not to respond in kind, but rather to act redemptively. I mean, how do you do that, and how do we get that attitude in our own hearts?
I think we can train our expected responses to situations and behave in a way that we think is appropriate for a Christian. But when something catches us off guard and a reaction is the normal response, I think that's a real test of what's in the vessel. If you break a glass jar full of muddy water comes out. You don't get honey. I once heard a preacher say that if you're full of mud or muck and somebody breaks your vessel, that's what's going to come out. It won't be honey. And my singer poked me in the arm and said, "Welcome, Muddy Buddy." Well, he knew that I was a reactionary too often. But when the Holy Spirit really fills us to overflowing, a continual flow, the vessel yielded to God, allowing that river of life and love and grace to flow through us, then the supernatural response to the unexpected is graciousness and forgiveness. And I can't, as a spirit-filled Christian and as a true lover of Jesus, can't choose not to forgive, because forgiveness lives in me. Grace lives in me. If I'm full of grace and truth, it won't be one or the other, but it will be both. Truth and righteousness kiss in the yielded life of the believer. So I'm just convinced that every time we see something that's disturbing to us, if we will pray for that person and ask God to use us to try to, in some way, point them to the redemptive love and transforming power of God, we'll actually find joy in that journey. And we actually see not only supernatural responses or reactions to what comes up unexpectedly, but we also see miraculous impact and transformation when we allow that power to flow.
And what you're saying, in short, it's not about me, it's about the other person. Because normally I'm thinking, you hurt me, you wounded me, you wronged me, and that's what I'm dealing with, as opposed to, how can I help you? You must be hurting, something's going on in your own life, but that's who Jesus is, that's who he is in us. And this just came up in a conversation with us the other day about someone that was in the spotlight for a little bit and seemed to be a bit of an unsavory character. And your immediate response was, "I want to love on this person." I thought, that's redemptive.
I'd already written a number of texts and made calls to people that might get me with this Anthony, who was let go by General Kelly, which was probably a very wise decision. But the decision on my part was that he hasn't perhaps met somebody who really loves Jesus, who's not going to just use religious rhetoric, but's going to really share truth, transforming truth. So I was immediately reaching out. And basically, it's the same way I went to be with Mr. Trump, was to love him. And I've never stopped. I just can't tell you how much that love flows every time I look at him. And I've seen the things that I don't think were the wisest thing at all. I pray for him. And one of the things I prayed for, because I was very bold with him and very one-on-one truthful with him and very forceful as possible for a man to be with another man. And his love deepened because of an unconditional love on my part, and everything I said was redemptive. I wasn't after anything for myself. I was after something for him and his family, and this family that we call the American people. And it moved him. So I'm praying that General Kelly right now will be that firm, strong voice that can look straight into the eyes of the president and speak truth to him. You know, one thing about the relationship that I have with people like that is they can't fire me. I wasn't necessarily invited. You know, the prophets weren't always invited back. Most of them weren't invited for the first meeting. So I know I'm sent. I don't get up in the morning wondering why I'm here. I've been sent by God. I'll be sent by God, led by God, and it's going to be for redemptive purpose. And there's something that's very disarming to people when you walk in like that. At first, it's kind of sets them back because they don't know how to deal with somebody that's not self-seeking. But when they really see that you love them and you want the best for them, it seems to have almost a contagious effect. And so I'm praying that right now for our president, and I'm praying for all of our leaders. I mean, I want Congress to learn to behave like a family. But why doesn't the church behave like a family? So we'll show them what that looks like. And you know, Michael, you've been with me with all these church leaders and all the diverse groups, and I'm trying to bring them together in a supernatural unity submitted to the one head, the one Father that really knows best. So we as Americans, we all, and as Christians, we need to be praying for that to happen, and we need to be asking God to help us behave in such yield as with yielded lives filled with the Spirit so that we actually reveal what Jesus is like, not some religious image or impression, but really, what is he like? And frankly, I see that in you. I in this two-year journey we've had together, I'm watching you grow, and I'm watching you become stronger. Everybody talks about how brilliant you are. I mean, Huckabee this morning said, boy, Michael Brown's brilliant. Man, he's brilliant. And I said, yes, but isn't he redemptive? Have you noticed how redemptive? Yes, that's really good, Michael said. Well, I think Mike Huckabee's the same way. I mean, Mike is redemptive too. And I think that's what we have to be, and we need to pray for our leaders. Don't stop praying. We have an enemy that is all out trying to destroy everything that's valuable, everything that is meaningful, and cause disarray and destruction, and they want to put us in darkness. The enemy's going to spend eternity in outer darkness. The father of lies wants to get us as much darkness as he can, both spiritually and, yes, physically. He wants to knock the lights out in our life, in our mind, and in our nation, and put us in darkness. He wants to tear us down. And we've got to stand in the power of the Holy Spirit, in the power of prayer and supernatural unity, and stand against these forces of deception and darkness. We have to do it. And I think we're seeing the answer to prayer right now. Maybe even what's happening in the shakeups, I think that's God answering people's prayers.
Mm. Now, you had a post on the stream, stream.org. By the way, all of my articles are posted there. I write one article a week exclusively for the stream, and then all the other articles, three, four other articles that I write for various websites, all on the stream, and then cutting-edge commentary on what's happening from the news, but all from these redemptive perspectives. James, you had a post linking to a video of yours about great news. We're all talking about fake news, but great news. So you're doing kind of these fireside chats now on Facebook. What are these about, and what are you trying to do through these chats as you encourage other believers?
Well, hopefully by this time tomorrow, if not by evening, I'm going to post a pretty thorough explanation of what I know in prayer for the last decade or more that the enemy intends for us. And I'm going to be very specific about it. I'm going to be very specific. As a matter of fact, I may title it something just to grasp what I'm sharing can save your life and millions of others. It can actually save us from the ultimate destruction the enemy intends. And so you pray for me, because that right now is coming to, let's say, in a Facebook post where it is brief enough that people stay with me, but it's not going to be so brief that I don't make it clear. I want to encourage people to really begin to look for substance and truth, and not just some little quick little excerpt that they don't meditate on. People don't even read today to be educated and enlightened. They simply do everything to try to be entertained, which is why so many of the YouTube posts are entertaining, and a lot of times they have to do with pets and wildlife, and everybody watches them, or there's some funny thing in a family. But we better also give earnest attention to someone who's actually speaking the truth that we must hear, because so often that truth will totally not only set us free personally, but can set us free nationally. And we can actually miss what the enemy is intending. In other words, we can short-circuit the enemy's intentions in the power of the Spirit. And I will guarantee you this, if the enemy ever has his way and does what he wants to do, the only way and the only people that will rise up out of the ashes to reveal what life really looks like will be the people who hear God, love God, and heed God. They're the only people that will be able to rise up
if the enemy gets his way in America. I am believing that we're going to get the mercy and grace and divine intervention of God. So I'll be talking about that. Perhaps even by this evening, you'll see it on Facebook. Just to Rev. James Robinson, and just listen up, see if you hear the Lord. On my Facebook page, it says, a father sharing his heart, seeking to share the father's heart.
Mm. Well, sir, keep it up. You're speaking to many, and we have a dearth of fathers today. So Rev. James Robinson on Facebook. I'll be looking for the post. Look forward to talking to you soon. God bless you.
God bless you, Doctor.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. So yesterday, I did my first show looking at specific Bible translations over the course of an hour. We've done other shows, and I've taken many questions about Bible translations, specific questions about specific translations, or generic questions about translation principles, or Hebrew and Greek questions. I've taken those endlessly. But I just thought, you know, let's spend a little bit more time, give you a bit more of a resource, spend the better part of an hour focusing on one version at a time, or genre of versions at a time. So we started with King James, the obvious place to start in the English world, English-speaking world, English-reading world, and talked about strengths of the King James and weaknesses of the King James. And for sure, it is not a perfect translation. There is no perfect translation. God's Word is perfect, but there's no perfect translation. However, if you will read the King James or the New King James, if you'll read the NIV or the NASB, if you read the ESV or the NET or the MEV or the HCSB or many, many other versions that were produced by believers, right, you will find that on all fundamental points of the faith, there is agreement. You will still come to the same conclusions about God. You will still come to the same conclusions about salvation. You will still come to the same conclusions about who Jesus is, etc. You may have one verse that you're expecting to say a particular thing in a particular way, and it doesn't, all right? But overall, the message will be the same. As far as how you should live as a believer, the overall message will be the same. But I gave a number of reasons as to why I recommend, if you are familiar with the King James and love the King James, to use a modern edition, a modern rendition, be it the New King James, be it the Modern English Version, the MEV, which use the same Greek manuscripts for the New Testament, and language, syntax that's familiar yet modernized, and correcting some of the mistakes, because there are many in the King James because it wasn't a perfect translation. And there are mistakes in translations today. And scholars will differ about this or that or why this or why that, and then the English language changed, etc. Well, a caller was referencing the end of Mark 16, and I just mentioned that verses 9 through 20 that we have in our Bibles, sometimes bracketed, sometimes not, are clearly not the original ending of Mark. Now, I believe that they are correct and true, that they reflect the words of Jesus himself, that it's in harmony with what's taught in the rest of Scripture. So I have no problem with people reading them, quoting them, preaching from them. I just say, we ought to say it's not the original ending of Mark. The vocabulary has changed, and there's a syntactic break. The grammar from verse 8 going to verse 9 does not make sense. So for whatever reason, in the providence of God, we don't have Mark's original ending, but we have this ending. Fine. Amen. I wasn't arguing against it. Some take a harder line about using it, but I wasn't. So a caller who's looked into this said, look, but you need to read what John Bergeon wrote, better known as Dean Bergeon or Bergeon, need to read what he wrote, and it's never been refuted. I said, well, it's been refuted many times. People on his side just don't believe it's been refuted. So here's an article, for example, by my friend Dr. James White, and it's at aomin.org, alphaandomegaministries.org. So if you type in aomin.org and then Dean Bergeon, B-U-R-G-O-N, you'll find this. But it's called Dean Bergeon and His Phantom Manuscripts. And this is written, 10 years ago. One of the most bizarre arguments made from King James-only advocates is the claim made popular by the late 19th century Dean Bergeon, attempting to explain why there are no extant Greek manuscripts with distinct KJV readings, or more specifically, distinct readings from a Greek Byzantine form of text from the first 300 years of church history. So, in other words, even though the majority of Greek texts that we have reflect the manuscripts used by the King James translators, or the manuscript, the Textus Receptus, the fact is that the so-called majority text is not reflected in the earliest texts. So that's the question. Well, where are they then? Why don't we have them? The logical answer would be, well, these must be additions, that these are not the original text, but these are additions. Extra words or phrases or things were put in, and the originals didn't have them. Well, according to Dean Bergeon, he claimed that because these manuscripts were so popular and were used extensively in the early church, they became, quote, worn out. Now, anytime you have to argue like that, you have a problem, that there is no evidence whatsoever to support your claim. So the only way to make your claim is to say, well, all the evidence must have disappeared. That's a difficult argument to maintain. Given that King James Version only advocates since Bergeon have not advanced any substantial arguments up to this day, you'll often hear this worn-out manuscript argument from many KJVO even today. Now, again, my issue is not with using the King James. If that's your preferred Bible, great. I memorized 4,000 verses out of the King James as a new believer. I read it cover to cover five times. I find it to be beautiful and powerful to this day. It just would not be my primary version. But if it's yours, fine, great. God bless you. Just make sure you understand the English well and here and there check another translation and things like that. But go for it. Great. If you're familiar with it, at home with it, preach out of it, God bless you. But if you say that is the only true English version or the others are satanic, that's where I tell you you're in serious error. Okay? So, James breaks this whole thing down, demolishes the argument, and points out that there are fundamental empirical historical problems with this claim. The most glaring problem is that there's not a single Greek manuscript, papyrus, or early version for the first 300 years of church history that contains a distinct KJV or Byzantine reading from a manuscript that reflects a Byzantine text. So you are arguing from silence, but not just from silence, you're arguing against all the evidence going in the other direction. Now, you may have a comeback for that. Fine. Here's my caution. If you love the King James and that's your preferred Bible, God bless you. I just preached at a church a few weeks ago, and they said, we preach out of the King James. So I preached out of the King James. No problem whatsoever. Again, I memorized more verses out of the King James and read through it cover to cover more than any other version, because I've read in other versions over the years and didn't do as much English memorization, tried to do more Hebrew memorization subsequently and things like that. So I've got great appreciation for it. It's the King James-only mentality, which is often a cult-like mentality and is based on massive misinformation. That's where I have my great issue. Okay, just another reminder. Here's how you get the free ebook, 5 Ways to Pray for America, Edifying, Practical, and Inspiring. When you pre-order Saving a Sick America on any of the websites where you'd normally pre-order it, be it Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Christian Book, then you just go to savingasickamerica.com. All the instructions are there. And when you do, you send the info on your pre-order and you'll get sent to you the ebook and the first 4 chapters of Saving a Sick America before it comes out in September. Could America's best days be ahead? Is it possible? Only with God. But with God, why not?